Welcome back to the Rav Hirsch on Parsha series for Parshas Matos Maaseh. And Rav Hirsch's commentary on these two Parshas covers a lot of ground. And I'm hoping this week's shiur we can do a few shorter pieces from Rav Hirsch's commentary rather than a smaller number of longer expositions. And we can see what Rav Hirsch has to say about a number of different discussions in these Parshios. Parshas Matos begins with Parshas Nedarim, the section that talks about vows and who can annul vows and how they can annul them. But the most important takeaway from this Parsha, this section of Parshas Matos, is the fact that a person is obligated to keep his word, and that the what a person commits himself to do is binding. And one unique aspect of Nidarim, as opposed to all the other mitzvot in the Torah, is the minimum age at which one is obligated in the mitzvah. For all mitzvot, as we know, the minimum age of obligation is bar or bas mitzvah, 13 for young men, 12 for young women. However, for Nidarim, the minimum age is lower. It is 12 for a boy and 11 for a girl, a year before they actually reach physical maturity and become responsible for keeping all the other mitzvos. And Rav Hirsch notes this idea, and he says that the reason why this may be is because these years, the years of an 11-year-old girl, a 12-year-old boy, as they are becoming mature and heading into adulthood, those years are very important. And I'll read you what Rav Hirsch writes in the commentary here. He says, in these years, the boy becomes a youth, and the girl becomes a maiden, and there is great significance to the resolutions that they vow in this period. These are resolutions uttered secretly, known only to God, but they are often decisive for a lifetime. The rich contents of the life of a noble man or noble woman are often only the ripened fruit of a resolution vowed to God in the dawn of youth. This would explain the loving seriousness with which God receives the vows of Ne'arim and Ne'aros, who are maturing into his service. So, Rav Hirsch has a very interesting idea here. His point is that the Torah requires an 11-year-old girl and a 12-year-old boy to keep their word even before they become adults, because the Torah wants to impress on these young adults, or these almost young adults, not quite young adults, but these youths, that they are about to enter a period of their lives of change, at a period of their lives where what they put their minds to now will set the tone for their adulthood, which is impending. And these decisions that they make, the path they set for themselves at this young age, will last them a lifetime. Their commitments are of great significance, even though they are not yet adults. But because they are nearly there at this period of time in their lives, they will be charting the course for years to come. And it's important to remember that when they commit themselves to do something, when they make a vow of some sort, they are obligated to keep it even at that age. Of course, the halacha is that even at this younger age, the requirement only devolves on them to keep their word if they are aware to whom they vow things. So if they are aware that their vows are sacred to Hashem, they understand the concept of God, then they are obligated. However, if an 11-year-old girl or 12-year-old boy does not understand the concept of God for whatever reason at that age, then isn't aware that their commitments are being made to him, then their vows are not binding until they become adults, in which case their vows are binding regardless. But this is an interesting idea, and something that I think many of us might wish we were more aware of at that age. But you see, the mitzvahs of the Torah are designed in a very wise way, where the hopes are that when a young and not yet adult notices that even their words take on a greater significance from at a young age, they recognize how important their actions, their mindset, and their decisions are, even at that point in time. The next section of Parshas Matos discusses the war against Midian. And upon their return from Midian, the soldiers were given a mitzvah by Elazar HaKohen, in which he told them about how to kosher their utensils that they brought back from war. And there are two aspects of this. One was called Avar Asher Yavo Va'esh Ta'aviru Va'esh V'Taher. Anything that comes in contact with fire had to be passed through fire to be purified, as we read in Perek Lamed Aleph, Pasuk Chaf Gimel. Meaning, this is we talk about libun, we talk about using a blowtorch to get something out, to take out the blios, the absorptions that come about through direct contact with fire. And then the pasuk says, "Ach b'mei nida yischata." However, it shall be purified. It shall purify itself in the mei nida, waters of nida, literally waters of separation, but he uses the term nida. And this refers to tevilas kelim, that any utensil which passes to us from non-Jewish hands must first be immersed in a mikveh. We know this refers to mikveh. Chazal tells us mei nida refers to mikveh because mei nida refers to mayim she nida tovelas bohen, water in which the nida immerses, meaning a regular mikveh. So we immerse our kelim in a mikveh as well. And Rav Hirsch explains that the idea behind tevilas kelim. He notes that tevilas kelim really only applies to metal food utensils. We extend this on a derabanan level to other materials, but midoraisa, it only applies to metal. And Rav Hirsch conceives of metal as something that represents man's intellect and his intellectual control over the earth and over the natural resources of the earth, because metal is mined from the ground in a raw state where it's not really useful, but because man with his intellect has developed a way to purify the metal, refine it, develop it, melt it down, and then craft it into an object that can be used constructively, so the metal vessel reflects man's creativeness, and man, which is through his mind and his intellect. Eating, which is done out of a food utensil, eating is a physical act. It is one that involves the senses, and it is one that is really just is because we have physical needs for our bodies that we must eat. So says Rav Hirsch, if a metal vessel is used for eating, that means that one is taking his intellect and the fruits of his intellectual labor and using it in the service of his senses, in the service of his physical side, of his physical nature, which is, of course, as we've seen in other conversations, especially particularly in Rav Hirsch's commentary about in his explanation of Basar B'Cholov, we've seen that this is a mindset that the Torah wants us to avoid at all costs. And so the Torah tells us to take a metal kli, and before we use this metal kli, the representative of our creativity and our intellect, and before we use that in the service of our senses and our physicality, we first dip it in the mikveh. And in the mikveh, what the mikveh does is it purifies it. And it indicates to us that even this metal kli, which we're using for eating, is being used in the service of, you know, is in the service of serving Hashem, and is being done so because we are going to serve Hashem and use our and the tevila is called Rav Hirsch says is referred to with the lashon chitoy of yischata, which really is from chait. But Rav Hirsch writes that chait, sinning, is the represents moral freedom, the ability to for a person to do to choose his own path, because the greatest freedom is the ability to sin. Without that ability, we would not be morally free. And when we so that Tevila calls this idea into consciousness. We talked about this in Parashas Chukas about the Paraduma, that the idea is that when instead of being bogged down by death and subjugation to the forces of nature that one might think about when coming into contact with death, so instead one is reminded that he has the freedom to choose and he has the freedom to determine his own path in life, and he's not subject to the forces of nature. And so the idea of this of dipping the kli, the kli used for food, into the mikveh is to say that we are not at the mercy of our physical side, of our nature. We have to eat, but we choose to utilize we eat, and then we use our physical side of our being, of our personality, in a way in which we see fit. We can control that. We are not slaves to it. Our intellect is not enslaved to our physicality, but we use our physicality in the service of our intellect. And that is something we have to be reminded of when using metal utensils in the act of eating. And this is how Rav Hirsch explains the concept of Tevilas Kelim in this week's Parsha. The final third of Parshas Matos discusses the request of Bnei Gad and Bnei Reuven to remain on the other side of the Yarden and settle in the lands of Sichon and Og. And Moshe grants their request. And at the very end of the parsha, we read about how different families from the Shvatim took over certain areas of this territory and lived there and set up their communities there before entering Eretz Yisrael to fight for that battle for the land. And the final pasuk of the parsha, we read, now, one family from Shevet Menashe, we read Novach Halach, that the family of Novach went, or Novach himself, perhaps, the head of his family, by Elkod Kenas v'Espinosel, he conquered Kenas and its suburbs, by Yikralah Novach Bishmo, and he called it Novach after his own name. The Medrash comments about this pasuk that the word La, by Yikralah Novach Bishmo, he called it Novach after his own name. The word la, which normally contains a mapik hay, a dugesh in the mapik hay that indicates that he called it. La means to it. It's referring back to that which we're talking about. That's the standard grammatic form of the word la. Here, la does not have a mapik hay. There's no dugesh in the hay, and Chazal tell us that's missing this dagesh to teach us melame shelo amad la osa shem, that name did not last, because it's missing something from the word la. Indicates that something was missing from this town Novach, which he named after himself, and what's missing is its endurance. It did not last very long. So Rav Hirsch explains. Now I'll read you what Rav Hirsch writes in the commentary. He says, Novach sought to immortalize himself in the name of the city and its daughter cities, but this name was not retained, and Novach did not attain his desire. So commenting here on Reverse's commenting here on the fact that Novach named the city after himself, he writes, does this perhaps imply a slight reproof of Novach? He sought to erect for himself an eternal memorial in structures of wood and stone. But that is not the way of a true Jew who seeks to immortalize himself on earth. For only through great feats of the spirit, through moral faithfulness to duty, and through the whole content of a noble life, will one's name be perpetuated through the ages. Now what Reverse is saying is, Reverse is not, I don't think he's saying that it is wrong for a person to name things after himself. In fact, in Hilchos Tzedakah, it is taught that one may name edifices or structures or donations after himself and take credit for donations to tzedakah, for example, because that will encourage others to give in the same way. But Rav Hirsch is criticizing Novak, or Rav Hirsch sees in the Midrash a criticism of Novak's intention to immortalize himself by putting his name on a town. And he says that this will be his memory for all future generations. When a person does this, it doesn't last. That's not the way to be immortalized, as Rav Hirsch puts it. The way to perpetuating one's own memory, perpetuating a legacy for future generations, is by living a life devoted to Hashem, a life devoted to Torah, and through the way he lives his life, he will perpetuate a legacy for his descendants. Not by putting his name on a building, putting his name on a town, or putting his name out there so that years later people will remember his name. The name alone is not enough for a person's legacy. A person's legacy will be built through the way he lives his life. His descendants will remember what he did, how he acted, the example he set as a role model for future generations. That is what a person should seek to do to perpetuate his memory and to establish a legacy that his descendants can look back on with pride and remember him. Then we move into Parshas Maaseh, which begins with the list of locations where the Jewish people stayed throughout their travels in the Midbar. And Rav Hirsch says here that he says, why does the Torah need to write the list of locations? But he says because it was important to remember the experiences that the Jewish people went through in the Midbar, the events that happened to them. So the Torah writes down the places where they stayed as a written record, but there is an oral tradition behind it in terms of what happened at each of these locations. We don't know, perhaps today, we don't remember anymore what happened at some of these more obscure locations which are not mentioned in greater detail in the Torah Shebichsav, but some of them we know. The location, the name of the place where they stayed, jogged a memory of what happened there, and it was important to preserve that. In fact, Rav Hirsch says, by knowing these locations, the descendants of these people, of the people who lived in the Midbar, would be able to go back and visit these locations, and they could see just how barren the desert is, just the full expanse of the wilderness. And he writes that it's an area, a region where even caravans that go through have to make sure to stock enough provisions, because otherwise they will not have anything left if they're not careful, and there's nothing to be had in that Midbar. And Rav Hirsch says that the very sight of these places will make an impact upon the people to see how Hashem took care of our ancestors in the Midbar. And it will be a tremendous lesson for us. And that's why these places are recorded in the Torah, so if we wanted to, we could go back and see it ourselves and truly appreciate what the kindnesses that Hashem did for our ancestors for all those years. Rav Hirsch also notes an interesting expression in the second pasuk in Parshas Maaseh, where the pasuk says, "Vayichtov Moshe es motza'ehem l'mas'ehem." Moshe wrote down their motza'ehem, means their. My first translation says decampments when they left l'mas'ehem for their journey. Api Hashem, which was done by the word of Hashem. Ve'elem mas'ehem l'motza'ehem. These were their journeys for their departures. And Rav Hirsch notes that at the beginning of the pasuk says Moshe wrote down their departures, which were for their travels, and says that then it concludes, repeats, these are the travels for their departures. But motza ehem and mas ehem are flipped in the second half of the pasuk, and Rav Hirsch explains that the ideal that Hashem intended was different than what the people actually realized. From Hashem's point of view, it was motza ehem l'mas ehem api Hashem. They were leaving. It was their departures for their travels. When they were leaving, the idea is to rise to a higher level, to come to a new place. There's something new to accomplish there. But for as far as the people were concerned, it was ve'elem mas ehem l'motza ehem. These were their travels for the sake of their departures. When they moved, it was just the most important thing was that they were leaving. They were getting away from where they were. They had just been sitting, and it didn't matter where they were going. The main thing was to just get up and go and to leave. And so their journeys were Mas Ehem L'motzah Ehem. But from Hashem's point of view, it was Motzah Ehem L'mas Ehem. And this is important for us, I think. It's a lesson we can all appreciate, that when we move to somewhere new, when we find ourselves in a new situation in life, the idea we shouldn't just be restless and be looking to change scenery just for the sake of changing scenery. We should recognize that when we have new situations in our lives, we can capitalize on them and grow from them. And Hashem puts us in different situations because there's something, a new goal that we can accomplish in these changing circumstances. It's not just that we're getting away from the old circumstances with nothing new to be seen and no value to be seen in the new circumstances. That was the wrongful approach of the people. And our approach should rather be that Motzah Ehem L'mas Ehem Api Hashem, that our departures, our changes to a new and better destination is always done up, is always Api Hashem, for the purpose of arriving at that destination and what we can accomplish there. Later on in the parsha, the Torah spends a significant amount of time on the mitzvah of Arei Miklat. When a person commits a murder accidentally, he runs to a city of refuge and must stay there until the death of the Kohen Gadol. And Rav Hirsch points to the final pasuk in this discussion of the Arei Miklat and shows how this pasuk really encapsulates the importance of punishing accidental murderers, and why this is something that's necessary to do from the outset of the Jewish people's arrival in Eretz Yisrael. The final pasuk, Perek, in this discussion, Perek Lamed He, pasuk Lamed Dalad, says, V'lo setameh sa'aretz asher atem yoshevim ba. You shall not defile the land that you are living in it, asher ani shochein b'socha, in which I dwell. Ki ani Hashem shochein b'soch b'nei Yisrael, for I am Hashem who dwells amongst b'nei Yisrael. And our first points here to the fact the pasuk repeats itself, seemingly, or describes two different reasons, describes the land in two different ways. It says, do not defile the land in which you live, in which I dwell. Because our verse says that we are required to take action when someone is murdered, even accidentally, because our entire Torah, our entire religion, is based on the concept of the dignity of man. The fact that man is created B'Tselem Elohim, and because man is created B'Tselem Elohim, therefore I have a responsibility to my fellow man, who is B'Tselem Elohim, and I must treat him well, and I must be kind to him, and I must also I must act with justice. And at the same time, I have a personal responsibility to myself to sanctify myself and live a moral life, because I am created B'Tselem Elohim. So the fact that we believe that man is created B'Tselem Elohim informs my personal responsibilities in my own life, and also my responsibility to my fellow man. Without the concept of B'Tselem Elohim, I have no responsibility to myself. I am just another animal. I can act as I please, and everybody else is just other fellow animals. And I can, and it's the survival of the fittest. And I can strong arm everybody else. And this is obviously undermines everything the Torah is all about. The Torah, the foundation of the Torah, is the concept of Ki B'Tselem Elohim Bara'as HaAdam, which is exactly how Hashem described the punishment of for murder to Noach and his sons. Because after all, Ritzicha is one of the Shevim Mitzvah Noach. And there Hashem explains, Ki shofech dam ha'adam, ba'adam damo yishofech. Someone who spills the blood of a man, by man shall his blood be spilled. The murderer is murdered himself. Ki b'tzelem elokim b'ra'as ha'adam. Because Hashem created man in his image. And that is the most important aspect for us to remember. And without tzelem elokim, the whole Torah falls away. Without Tzelem Elohim, with the whole Torah falling away, and I feel responsible to nobody, I'm just another animal. This is, of course, how Rav Hirsch defines Tumah. As we discussed earlier, and again in Parshas Chukas, Tumah means slavery to forces of nature and a lack of freedom. And that's how animals live, following their instincts, gratifying their senses. That's tuma. And so the Torah says, "Velositamei sa'aret, do not defile the land through murder. Do not bring tuma through murder." And how is the land defined? Asher atem yoshvim ba, you live there. Asher nushchem sochan, I dwell there. Meaning, both the foundation of both human society and the presence of Hashem is Tzelem Elokim. And Tzelem Elokim, which results in a value of human life that should prevent murder and should prevent even accidental murder, because a person should refrain from doing anything that could lead to an accident if he recognizes the fact that Tzelem Elokim, that everybody else is Tzelem Elokim, and he values human life. He will not do anything foolish that might lead to an accident. He'd be more careful, more vigilant. So do not defile the land, because your societal life, your communal life, Asher Atem Shiyoshvim Ba, is dependent on the recognition of Tzelem Elokim. And Asher Ani Shochim Besocha, Hashem's presence in our lives is also dependent on Tzelem Elokim. And then we conclude, Ki Ani Hashem Shochim Besoch B'nei Yisrael, for I am Hashem who dwells among B'nei Yisrael. Because Hashem wants His presence to be among us. We should each be make ourselves and our families and our homes and our communities a residence for the Shekhinah. And again, Tzelem Elokim is the foundation of that. And that is why, because it's such a foundational idea and it's central to the rest of the Torah, Hashem commanded Moshe Rabbeinu that the first thing that is done upon entering Eretz Yisrael is Ari Mikla. Moshe Rabbeinu set up Ari Mikla and Eivor HaYarden before they even went to Eretz Yisrael. And as soon as they finished conquering the land, the first thing Yehoshua did, before they even that, well, it's recorded in Sefer Yehoshua even before they conquered the land. When it happened is another story, depending on how you on when you want to place the event in the chronology of Sefer Yehoshua. But at a very early point in their takeover of Eretz Yisrael, Yehoshua sets aside Ari Miklat. This is one of the first things that is done. Why? Because it sets the tone for the meaning of the Jewish state. The Jewish state, the Torah state, is based on a recognition of Tzelem Elokim. Rav Hirsch writes to explain this idea. These concluding sentences illuminate the laws of Rotzeach and Ari Miklat. Fulfillment of these laws was to be the first national duty upon the conquest of the land. Indeed, Moshe had already implemented these laws in the Transjordanic territory that he conquered. They are indicative of the sanctity of the life of even the lowliest citizens of the land. With the very proclamation of the value of life, God's people shall take possession of its land. This state shall regard the lives of its citizens as its most precious and most sacred asset, and the nation as a whole is held responsible for every minute by which the life of any one of its members is prematurely curtailed. And this is why Ari Miklat occupy such an important place in the Torah, why Jewish society and Jewish relationship with Hashem is dependent on it, and why it had to be done from the first moment of entry into the land. Finally, at the very end of the parasha, we revisit the story of Benos Tzlafchad. We were introduced to Benos Tzlafchad in Parshas Pinchas, and we read that they were entitled to inherit their father's portion of Eretz Yisrael because he had no sons, and so the daughters inherited them. But their kinsmen in Shevet Menasheh complained to Moshe, and they said that if the Benos Tzlafchad marry men from other tribes, then their children will belong to the tribe of their father from that other Shevet, and the land will go to them, and Shevet Menasheh will lose out on land. And so Moshe went to Hashem, and Hashem said that the members of Shevet Menasheh were correct, and Hashem commanded that in this case, where women were inheriting land, they were required to marry within their own Shevet, so that the land not be lost. However, we know that this was not a permanent solution, And Rav Hirsch sees this in the introduction of this section, where Hashem's instructions are introduced with the word Zeh HaDavar. This is the word. And Rav Hirsch says, anytime we say Zeh HaDavar, it implies an immediate fulfillment. It's a commandment for the here and now, not necessarily long term. And it only applied for that generation which entered the Eretz Yisrael. We find later on in Sefer Shoftim, at the end of Sefer Shoftim, when after it already had been a few generations in Eretz Yisrael, so then they permitted the Shvatim to marry, intermarry with one another, and they lifted this restriction, and we know that that's one of the reasons why Tu B'Av was a great day of celebration, a day of joy, because Tu B'Av was the day on which they permitted the Shvatim to marry within one another. So Rav Hirsch says, why is it that the requirement to marry within the Shevet was only for this generation that entered Eretz Yisrael and did not last for all future generations as well? If it's important that the land not transfer between Shvatim, then it should be a permanent solution. And if it's not important, then why did it apply to Bnos Slavchad and their contemporaries? So Rav Hirsch explains that it was important at the very beginning of settling Eretz Yisrael, is important that each Shevet's section should be kept intact, because the very outset, the beginning, is when they would take root in the land and would set the tone for the future. And before each Shevet, as we know, had their own mission, had their own specialization, they had their own characteristics. For those unique characteristics to take hold, they had to be able to develop on their own first before they would mingle with the other Shvatim. And so Hashem wanted the initial generation that entered Eretz Yisrael to be to them, kept to themselves, to keep that land whole, so that their own tribes' characteristics would be able to flourish and develop in isolation. Once they had taken root, and that character trait had become part of their tribal identity, they could then go out to the other Shvatim and intermarry and share that with the other Shvatim, because it would still be able to last beyond even and withstand interactions with other Shvatim. If these characteristics were exposed to competing characteristics from the outset, it would not be able to withstand that exposure. This is similar to able to withstand that exposure, but when kept in isolation and allowed to grow a little bit first before being put out there, then it would be able to serve its purpose. Rav Hirsch writes here. He says, it is especially important to preserve the nachalos at the beginning of and in the period immediately following the possession of the land. Each nachala in its entirety should be handed over to the tribe for which it is suited, so that tribe should maintain possession of it, and every possible precaution should be taken to avoid the intermingling of the tribes as a result of the laws of inheritance. In all subsequent times, the tribes are not prohibited by the Torah to intermingle and to intermarry. On the contrary, three times a year, the nation in its entirety is to assemble around the national sanctuary, a mitzvah that is to bring about the actualization of complete national unity. But precisely for this reason, it is necessary at the beginning that each nachala be stamped with the specialty of its inhabitants, that the members of each tribe with their unique characteristics strike roots in the nachala given to them, and that they both, people and nachala, become interconnected and bound up with one another, so that the individual development of each tribe shall be assured forever. The foregoing would explain the command that instructs the daughter who inherits to marry only within her own tribe, and would also explain why this command is limited to the first generation of those who took possession of the land. This is an important lesson for us as well in our own lives. We can talk about how it's important for our, to be firmly rooted in one's own community before one takes a look around and sees what else is out there, and investigates what other communities have to offer. We can look at it in terms of how we raise our children, in terms of giving them a secure footing in Torah and in mitzvos and in a Jewish home before we expose them to the rest of the world. Because again, when one is not fully confident and fully developed in his own characteristics and culture, so to say, then he will not be able to withstand exposure to other views. But once one is confident, fully developed in those views, he can then be exposed to other views, and his own personal values will be able to withstand the exposure, and together, and will be able to, he'll be able to put the two together and utilize that for personal growth.